Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, May 13th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga OBGYN at Myrtle Street and the new physician midwife pregnancy care model at Saratoga Hospital, saratogahospital.org. For more information, joining us on this Medical Monday is Dr. Gabriel Kaufman of St. Peter's Breast Surgery in New York, in Albany, New York, of course. He specializes in disease of the breast as well as plastic and reconstructive surgery. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. So that's Dr. Gabriel Kaufman and your calls, all coming up on the Vox Pop right after this news. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Medical Monday, WAMC's live call-in talk show, and I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today is a great guy, Dr. Gabriel Kaufman of St. Peter's Breast Surgery of Albany, New York, board-certified in general surgery and specializes in diseases of the breast, as well as plastic and reconstructive surgery. Dr. Kaufman received his medical degree from New York Medical College in Valhalla. He completed a residency and fellowship at New York University School of Medicine in New York and the Paris Breast Institute in France. His internship was at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Dr. Kaufman, Gabriel Kaufman, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thank you so much, Alan.
So, Gabe, if I may call you that, let me ask you a question. What is an awful lot of people are worried these days about breast implants? And could you just move that a little bit closer to your face? Thank you. What's the poop? Are they dangerous?
So it's a complicated question, and I think to open the discussion, the concept of breast implant has been around since the 1960s, mm-hmm. With Dow Corning. And two gentlemen made the invention and took it to fruition. And it's been a rocky history over the course of the 1990s and early 2000s. There was a FDA moratorium on the use of silicone implant. And the moratorium was lifted. The concern was there was an association between the silicone and connective tissue disease. And through many, many studies, population-based studies, large studies, the association could not be proven, and the moratorium was lifted. Since this time, starting in the late 1990s, there was a recognition of a separate entity. So the first entity I was discussing is breast implant illness. The second entity I want to discuss is an association with the implant and lymphoma.
Oh, interesting.
So it's a WHO-recognized disease process. It's called breast implant-associated anaplastic large cell lymphoma. And the realization after the initiation of record-keeping from both the Society of Plastic Surgery and also from the FDA is that there's a strict association with textured implants. So a majority of implants utilized in the United States are smooth, and a minority, about 20%, have been textured. So they've made a very strong association between anaplastic lymphoma associated with implants and textured implants specifically.
Now, what does textured mean?
On the outer surface of the covering of the device,
yes,
the manufacturing process creates intricate pores that allow adhesion to the tissue. And the purpose of this was to avoid capsular contracture, which is a complication of using implants. So through the manufacturing process, they developed a technology or an innovation to avoid a complication related to the device. It was not known at that time, however, that this could result in or lead to down the road a microenvironment allowing for the development of a lymphoma.
So now, doctor, when people come to you and say, a woman comes to you and says, I want this, do you say, no, that's not a good idea?
So the answer to the question, it's interesting. I was in Toronto at a conference about 3 weeks ago, and as we were plastic surgery conference, and as we were discussing this issue from the Canadian perspective at the conference, the Canadian health ministries made a decision to pull textured implants from use in Canada. At that same time, the French government was also pulling textured implants from use. In Brazil, they pulled textured implants from use, and the FDA here in the United States has not made that recommendation yet. So the recommendation from the FDA regarding textured implants is with use if needed with caution and with full open discussion with all of the risks and benefits of that device. However, there is an option of smooth implant, and that has not been associated with this type of lymphoma.
Without getting political, I can tell you that the most famous quote out of Donald Trump's mouth has involved the size of women's breasts. He goes into this very famous thing. What is it? What is it that we Americans admire? Is it the size of breasts? What?
So breast implant, it's interesting because the first breast augmentation or reconstruction was performed in the 1890s by a famous German-Austrian surgeon, and he used the patient's own fat to reconstruct the breast or to make the breast larger. So as a plastic reconstructive surgeon, we're using all of the innovation of silicone from the 1960s to help us reconstruct women who have had breast cancer and undergone mastectomy. So there's definitely a reconstructive purpose for this device. Now, there are other ways to reconstruct the breast. That's not the only way to do it. However, to answer your question, in regards to breast augmentation as a cosmetic operation, true, it is the most common cosmetic operation in the United States, second only to liposuction.
Huh, that's amazing.
So that's 300,000 cases a year. These are numbers that are provided from the American Society of Plastic Surgery on their website.
Now, you, doctor, deal with people who obviously are ill, who have cancer, and you do surgery on those folks, right?
That's correct. So I have a dual role in the relationship with the patient who comes to the practice with a diagnosis of breast cancer, and then we discuss the options of surgery and treatment and cure for the breast cancer diagnosis, but I also involve myself in the discussion regarding reconstruction after a proposed mastectomy.
And what is the cure rate after 5 years for people with breast cancer?
I think we've done a very good job treating women with breast cancer who present with stage 1, 2, 3, and even 4, which is metastatic disease. I think the science, the understanding, and the treatment options have progressed significantly since I started my training. And for stage 1 and stage 2 disease, the long-term cure rates are very good. However, we are a little bit perplexed in the field at late recurrences, which we can see 15 to 20 years down the line.
That's so interesting. I know we have a friend who went through that. Is there a reason for that? Some of the tumor is still there? Some of the cells are still there?
I'm not sure the answer to the late recurrence problem, why we see that, but there's definitely an issue with the host or the patient's immune system in terms of surveilling for cancer. So there may be an inherent problem with the patient and their ability to detect change in the cellular level. So I'm not sure that we know the answer to that, but it's a real phenomenon.
Very interesting. Very quickly, because we have to go to a break, let me go to Jim in Matamoros, who is always our number one caller. Go ahead, Jim.
What type of suture materials are used in reconstruction?
So in the reconstructive process, I prefer to use suture material, Jim, that is dissolvable. I don't use permanent type suture, and I've never had a problem with that. I like to avoid using things that are permanent.
Okay, thank you, Jim. The telephone number here, and we'll be taking a lot of calls in just a few minutes. Right now, there's no one on the phone. If you get on the phone, you will be on 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. In the meantime, we're going to take a very short break, and we'll be right back. And we are back with Dr. Gabriel Kaufman of St. Peter's Breast Surgery in Albany, New York, board certified in general surgery and specializes in diseases of the breast as well as plastic and reconstructive surgery. Where does breast cancer fit on the list of most often seen cancers? Is it number one or number two?
I think for women, outside of a diagnosis of skin cancer, breast cancer would be up there with number one. My interest in the field is primarily based on the biology and innovation that's happened over the past decade, and the efforts by both scientists and clinicians to really make an impact on this very, very common disease process affecting 1 in 10 women in the United States and the Western world.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. This is your chance. You call now, you get in now. So, Gabe, I guess the question is, do we have any sense of any of the stats relating to breast cancer and other phenomena? For example, breastfeeding and breast cancer. You hear a lot of, sort of tales from the Wild West, but do we know anything?
I think we do. I mean, I think there is something about breastfeeding and the reduction in risk, lifetime risk of breast cancer. But there are other, as I tell my patients, holistic things we can do in terms of reducing risk. As simple as daily exercise, moderate, eating your vegetables in the calciferous vegetable group, such as cauliflower, broccoli, kale. These are all anti-inflammatory. I propose vitamin D for my patients in the Northeast as another mechanism of holistic risk reduction. But once we know a patient is at significantly higher risk compared to the general population, then we have in our armamentarium various chemoprophylactic medications we can offer. And I work closely with a medical oncology team to coordinate that.
And so there have been some major breakthroughs. By the way, the telephone number is 1-800-348-2551. It has happened in the past that sometimes the communication process breaks down and the people who are calling don't get through, in which case I'd really like to know about that. 1-800-348-2551. Okay, so is it tamoxifen? What is the name of the drug?
So I'm referring to a medication called tamoxifen, which essentially the role is to block the impact of estrogen on the breast tissue. We know that estrogen is a major driving force related to the development of breast cancer. So there have been large studies. One of the major studies was the STAR trial, which looked at tamoxifen and risk reduction, and the impact was significant. There was a 50% reduction in women who were utilizing tamoxifen to reduce the risk of breast cancer.
And what is tamoxifen?
So tamoxifen falls into a category of medication that is a selective blocker of estrogen and how its uptake into the breast tissue, into a breast cell. So it blocks the receptors sitting on the breast cancer, on the breast tissue itself, on a normal cell, and it doesn't allow the cell to react to the stimulation. The reaction we're trying to avoid is division of the cell. And through division is how cells develop mistakes. And through the mistakes, you develop the malignancy.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, let's go to Jennifer in Rhinebeck. All right, Jennifer in Rhinebeck, you're on.
Hello, hi. My sister was last year diagnosed with breast cancer and had a tumor removed and went through therapy afterwards. When my doctor found out about that, she prescribed for me, I forget the name of it, but it was like a augmented mammogram. Not the usual, but kind of the next level. When I went to schedule it, it turned out that my insurance company wasn't going to pay for it. So my doctor felt that I was now at a greater risk and should have it, but the insurance company didn't. And I'm wondering if, you know, if you have any advice on whether that's something I should push for, try to fight the insurance company, what my odds are of being successful with that would be. Any thoughts on that?
Jennifer, thank you for your question. And I know that at St. Peter's, all of the mammogram that patients are receiving at this point are the augmented version of that. And that's a 3D tomosynthesis type of mammogram where the images come through almost like a CAT scan. So the radiology team can scroll through the breast with multiple images, and the difference between the traditional mammography, traditional digital mammography, and the 3D version of that is significant in terms of detection of abnormality in the breast. And I know from a few years ago that there was difficulty, there was with the insurance companies in terms of coverage for that type of mammogram. However, I'm not sure today where we stand, but I agree with your physician and their pushing towards the more advanced technology. And I think this is an innovative process that actually helps patients.
Thank you, Jennifer. All right. Now we're going to, let's see here, Stuart in Stone Ridge. Stuart in Stone Ridge, your turn. Go.
Yes, hello. Doctor, I have a question about the genetic predispositions. Not so much BRCA2 as PALB2. I have a niece who had has had breast cancer successfully treated, but in the diagnostic phase, she was found to have PALB2. And so a number of the family members have checked ourselves out to figure out who has it and who's passing it along. I'm wondering what you know about PALB2 and any dispositions, predispositions that might be relevant to men as well as women.
So the genetics of breast cancer and the germline mutation is a very intricate topic. And the two most common mutations that are evaluated are the BRCA mutations. Those are the two mutations that are very well known and confer a very high lifetime risk of breast cancer. When patients are screened genetically, they look at a panel of testing now. I'm not sure the exact number of mutations we're screening for. It could be upwards of 20.
Wow.
And PLBA2 is one of them. The ultimate risk associated with that type of mutation, I could not quote you. I'm not a geneticist. I mean, it gets very, very intricate. And I think it's based on more the family experience, the family history, what type of malignancies, what age was the diagnosis. So I think all of these things start to play a factor into taking action. With the BRCA, it's fairly standard in terms of how we counsel patients in terms of risk-reducing strategy. With some of the newer type of genetic mutations, I think we're a little bit uncharted, but I think there are patients, these are patients that more likely than not become in or are entered into a high risk screening protocol, for example, for the breast or maybe for the colon, depending on what system is affected. And male breast cancer is real. I treat a fair number of men who have the diagnosis. It is something that we should all be aware of. It's a real entity.
Do people come to you, Dr. doctor and ask you to remove their breast because they have the genetic mutation?
So it is not uncommon to have patients who have a recent diagnosis of a mutation and require risk-reducing strategy. And that can range from enhanced surveillance or surgery to remove the at-risk tissue. So that is very common.
And our caller, Stuart, had an interesting question. You mentioned BRCA and the breast cancer. What about others? What sites do they go to in males?
So the BRCA mutation, we know in women, the ovary and the breasts are the high risk tissue, but there are other organs which are at risk, such as pancreatic, perhaps prostate. So it's a whole number of organ systems that are at higher risk of developing malignancy.
So should every male as well as female get tested for whether they have these mutations?
That's a good question. There's coming from the societies, the American Society of Breast Surgeons and other societies, there was a push that all women who have a diagnosis of breast cancer should be considered for genetic evaluation. We may be missing 10 to 15 to 20% of women who have a genetic predisposition. We're not picking it up because the family history is not allowing us to. So there is an argument that all women should be tested who present with breast cancer. I think that would be a little bit challenging for the system. And I've refined that to testing women who have specific types of breast cancer where having that knowledge would, in fact, impact treatment. And that would be specifically in women who have triple negative breast cancer.
What does that mean?
So breast cancer has personality. And we look at the cover of the book. So we look at the cover or the personality of the breast cancer to guide us in treatment. And triple negative is when all three of the receptors on the breast cancer are negative, and that's usually a more aggressive breast cancer. And there are treatments which work specifically for patients who have the BRCA mutation.
Well, you got us into it, but I want to ask you, pancreatic cancer, which of course is what so many people are scared of, the third largest cancer in the United States. And if the BRCA, among others, may lead to it, and we have no real diagnosis for it until it's too late, shouldn't everybody be tested for it?
So I'm not aware of any screening protocol for patients who have a BRCA mutation. I think it's just one of the tip-offs if we see in the family that there happens to be a pancreatic cancer with a colon cancer and a breast cancer.
Stuart, see what you got us into? Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Okay, and now 1-800-348-2551. Fascinating program. 1-800-348-2551. Roger in Adams, Massachusetts. Okay, Roger, go.
Hello. We've all heard of heart transplants, kidney, others. I've never heard of a breast transplant. Are there such things?
It may sound like science fiction, but there are teams in Australia who have been working on a construct of creating breast from single cells. So that's not science fiction. That is possible. And when we opened up the discussion, we discussed silicon implants for reconstruction. However, there are three other modalities available. And the closest to that we have today is transplant surgery, where we take the patient's own fat cells and use them to reconstruct the breast.
Which was the late 1800s you mentioned.
So it is a version. So we're going back to the 1800s.
Yes.
And that became extremely popular, and that's one of the techniques I was privileged to see in Paris.
You would think any natural cell would be better than unnatural. Are they successful?
So here's the catch. There's no free lunch. And the controversy with lipofilling or fat grafting for breast reconstruction is that, are there special properties of the fat cells that may provoke or allow for breast cancer to evolve? And that was a big concern among breast reconstruction specialists. And the answer is, in the laboratory in the University of Pittsburgh, it's been shown that fat cells, adipocytes, have the potential to potentiate breast cancer in active cells that are, in fact, dividing. Large studies from Italy, there's a Milan 646 study, which did not demonstrate an increased risk of recurrence of breast cancer in these patients. However, when I was training in Paris, there was a moratorium on fat grafting just for this concern.
I suppose you could graft from somebody else who could have cancer.
Well, you're grafting from the patient,
oh, so your own
so it's auto transplant,
right? What site did they usually graft from?
When I graft, when I harvest, I'm usually using the abdomen. That's usually enough to reconstruct the breast. But there are other sites which a transplant surgeon can go to do that.
Roger, thank you very much. I'm sorry about that. I really didn't mean to cut you off. So breast augmentation is one thing you deal with. How about breast diminishment? People want to have smaller breasts too. Is that dangerous?
Absolutely not. I mean, breast reduction surgery is very safe. You're removing tissue. You're moving tissue to, in a sense, reconstruct the breast back to its natural shape. And the benefit for my patients is I see an incredible alleviation of a whole syndrome or constellation of pain related to the neck, the back, the shoulders. It's just from an engineering standpoint, you can imagine anything that's cantilevered off the body is tremendous stress. So when you reconstruct the breast and put it back to its natural position, it's much more ergonomic.
Huh. Well, now let's go, if we can, to Kate in Wappingers. Okay, Kate, your turn. Go ahead.
Hi. My question was about breastfeeding and breast cancer. About 5 years ago, I had a lump in my breast, and I got pregnant, and they had a mammogram done, and the breast surgeon, the doctor who looked at the mammogram, said he thought it wasn't cancerous. And I've gone now, it's been about 3 years, I've been breastfeeding my kids, and the lump has actually gotten smaller. Do you have any connection with those things or any comments, I guess? I'm curious.
So the diagnosis of breast cancer can be very, very complicated, and you rely on clinical exam, history, diagnostic evaluation, and time. Time will tell, and in general, malignancy grows. So things that are diminishing in size, a palpable finding, diminishing in size within the breast would be unlikely to be a malignancy. So we often have patients come back for interval examination on the clinical side to determine whether or not we're dealing with a malignant event. The particular diagnosis here could be a whole host of benign type breast entities related to breastfeeding, but very unlikely to be malignancy 3 years into the mix at this point.
Okay, thank you. You know, I know women who have reported fibroids, and they have to go a lot to check it out that it's not cancer, that it's just fibroid. Is that one of your jobs?
Exactly. So we deal with not only malignancy, but benign diseases of the breast. Fibroadenoma is particularly common. And that is an entity as a surgeon that we help patients with, either through reassuring that it's not malignancy or surgically, if the fibroadenoma is large and growing and causing discomfort or deformity.
Is there anything serious about the fibroids?
I don't think there's anything serious. My concern is if the fibroadenoma grows to a size where it causes compression of the breast tissue and deformity of the shape. And at that point, I tend to offer excision. and also patients who are considering pregnancy because estrogen can stimulate the growth of the fibroid adenoma and they can get very large.
Okay, now, Doc, don't forget that. We want to talk about estrogen when we come back from our brief sojourn into another world. We will be right back. We are back with a great guest, Dr. Gabriel Kaufman of St. Peter's Breast Surgery in Albany, New York, board certified in general surgery, specializing in diseases of the breast. Okay, so a while back, 1-800-348-2551. Right now, you call, you get in. 1-800-348-2551. A while back, the big issue was estrogen. Estrogen replacement, whether you do it, whether you don't do it. Is that debate basically solved now, or is it still going on?
I think that raises a tremendous number of questions, and the debate was answered a number of years ago. I remember being in San Antonio, Texas, at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, and there were studies looking at hormone replacement therapy. And during that conference, was decided that the maximum number of years that a woman should have hormone replacement was 3, and that after 3 years, that there was an increased risk of breast cancer.
So let me just get this straight. You were doing hormone replacement because you were going through menopause and you were having a tough time. So hormone replacement was recommended by some, and some said, I don't want to touch this. It's really awful.
Well, the answer is you can do it, but there seemed to be a correlation with time, duration and exposure to the therapy and the risk of breast cancer. So that was, you know, based on a large study that came out. I can't tell you the exact year, but I would think in 2010 to 12 from the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. Now, it brings up another issue that patients often ask about fertility treatment. So does fertility treatment increase the risk of breast cancer? And through large studies from the Netherlands, the answer is no. So fertility treatment, where you have exposure to exogenous hormone, does not increase the risk of breast cancer.
How about, by the way, the telephone number is still 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. I'm going to have to get the telephone people down here because I have to tell you, I'm astounded by the fact that we're not showing any calls, and this is such an interesting subject that I have to only suspect something ain't right here. So in either case, I know we have a group of cracked engineers upstairs who deal with this kind of thing every once in a while when it happens. 1-800-348-1. 1-800-348-2551. All right. So how about various diseases, sexual diseases, sexual orientation diseases? Do we know that there's any kind of relationship to breast cancer there?
I'm not aware, Alan, of an association between a sexually transmitted disease or a virus and breast cancer. And breast cancer development or development of malignancy is always, you know, it's multifactorial. It's environment, it's genetics. So there are many factors related to the development of malignancy. However, I'm not aware of a transmitted virus or bacteria that would promote that.
Huh. Very interesting. All right. So because I asked, there are now 5 phones that are up. Or as the old joke goes, sorry I asked. All right. Let's go to Carmela in New York City. Carmela, you're on.
Hi, this is Carmela in New York. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling to find out that, okay, when I went for a mammogram, I had like 2 lumps in my breast. But when I came out of the mammogram, it seemed to me like the lumps had split up. And now I wound up with like 3 or 4 lumps.
So, Carmela, that's a very interesting question. And what you're asking is the compressive force of the mammogram, can that alter or change the composition of the breast tissue or what you're finding? And I think that's very unusual. However, I have seen cases with patients who have breast implants, and it is possible that the force exerted could cause rupture of the device. I have seen that in my practice.
So wait a second. So there are women who...
Fake breasts. These are my breasts.
No,
we got that. But there are a lot of women who complain that the compression when they are having mammograms is hurtful.
Yes.
Question is, doctor, I guess, you're saying that you're not aware that that compression causes multiplication of the cancer.
So Carmela, I'm not sure exactly what happened in your particular case, but I'm not aware of the ability of a diagnostic test to change the composition of the breast. So it's a little confusing to me.
One more quickie. Would a sonogram be better than a mammogram?
That is a great question. So ultrasound combined with mammography is a very effective combination of diagnostic imaging and screening imaging that can be used to detect early breast cancer. That is a very effective modality.
Thank you, Carmela. Okay, and now on to... who is that down there? Number. Oh, we'll go to Mary on line 7. Mary, you're on.
Yes. Hello. Thank you for taking my question. I have been using Premarin cream for at least 20 years now, and I was wondering of the effects of the Premarin cream on causes of breast cancer, if there's any connection with any causality with breast cancer and Premarin cream.
So, doctor, what is Premarin cream?
That's a great question, but it's essentially going to entail a combination of steroid, if it's estradiol, estrogen. So you're exposing to exogenous steroid, and estrogen is a steroid. So the answer is, Mary, that I'm not aware of use of a cream like that potentiating or causing breast cancer. But if you had a diagnosis of breast cancer, you would probably be asked to stop using that cream.
Okay, thank you. No, I haven't had a diagnosis yet, but every year is, it's always a concern.
Thank you, Mary.
So, thank you very much.
Bye-bye. My pleasure.
Okay, we'll go now. This is interesting. I don't know who's on line number 6, but we're going there. Line number 6, your name isn't there, but who are you?
Hey there, this is another Mary. This is from Great Barrington.
Okay.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, neighbor.
Hi there. I've got a question for you. I just was to see my orthopedic doctor. I'm 9 years past menopause, and my bone mass had dropped significantly. I did not do any hormone treatment or therapy because I got that same story that it would be a breast cancer risk. But, you know, she was really saying that the risk to my bone from not having that estrogen might be equal to the risk of breast cancer. So, or maybe worse. So that's a question. Can you talk about that?
So in regards to, you know, bone health and breast cancer, I'm not sure of the direct correlation, but there happens to be an estrogen modulator called raloxifene, which does increase bone density and bone health. And that was looked at as a risk-reducing strategy for breast cancer. The impact on both bone health was a secondary benefit. We do not see that benefit for risk-reducing strategies like tamoxifen. It was only seen in the raloxifene medication.
Mary, gotta let you go. Go ahead.
Yeah, would that be? I mean, with the hormone therapies that anybody might have taken, or the bioidentical hormones, were those? I mean, she was saying that would be actually a benefit to my bones. Maybe that the risk would be higher for my bones not to have the estrogen, which I didn't have all this time. Or that's the piece I'm trying to understand.
The question is the correlation between estrogen and bone health. And
yeah.
As everyone goes through their life cycle, we are losing bone density. And I think there are, again, holistic, you know, methods of maintaining bone density. And that's, you know, essentially stressing the bone. That's probably the number one thing you can do. And that's, you could think of like biking, weightlifting, walking, just general exercise. So I don't think you lost anything. I don't think that you missed out. And, you know, in regards to hormone replacement therapy, again, it's based on the time frame of use, not the actual use. So we were looking at greater than 3 years. So there was a time frame where it was considered safe to use hormone replacement
therapy.
Thank
you very much, Mary. Okay, not to keep on this too long, but there are a whole host of new medicines that are being used for bone loss now. Do we know if any of those are potentially cancer-causing?
I'm not aware of medication that reduces the risk of bone loss impacting risk of breast cancer.
Gotcha.
So I think there's no association.
Gotcha. Okay. We'll go to Susan in Northwest Connecticut. Susan in Northwest Connecticut. We're running out of time. Go fast. Go ahead.
Okay. I have a question about raloxifene. I am following a lumpectomy for severe atypical ductal hyperplasia. The oncologist recommended raloxifene, so I take it daily, 60 milligrams, as a cancer preventative. I had been taking, prior to the lumpectomy, risedronate for osteoporosis and osteopenia. The gynecologist then said I could stop the risedronate because of the bone strengthening effects of the raloxifene, but is that enough, the raloxifene by itself?
I think that's a wonderful question, and I'll be the first to admit when something's a bit out of my level of expertise. But what I can tell you, Susan, is that raloxifene has the potential to increase bone density. So it's not a lose-lose here. I think you are gaining something with the raloxifene. And you may be losing a percentage of impact from the other medication, but there's a gain here, and it's not negligible.
Right.
Susan,
right.
Susan, I'm so sorry. Susan, we're running out of time.
Okay, thank you very much.
I want to get everybody else in. Thank you, dear. Let's go to Allison in Goshen, Massachusetts. Allison, as you just heard, we're running out of time. What do you got?
Yes, a quick question. Another question of a hormonal I'm, 18 years post-menopause. I'm taking estradiol vaginal inserts, Uvathum. Do you think this would be any additional risk for developing breast cancer?
Allison, I'm not aware of the increased risk of breast cancer with a device such as the one you're using. We were talking about hormone replacement therapy, which I think is a little bit different. But
yeah.
Again, if you were ever unfortunate and had a diagnosis of breast cancer, I think your physicians would recommend removal of that device.
Yes, I see.
Thank you. Thanks, Allison. All right, and now on to Val in Colebrook, Connecticut. All right, Val in Colebrook. We're running out of time, Val. What do you got?
It's a real quick question. I have heard that when individuals have breast implants, it's much more difficult to do a mammogram. Is that true?
Val, great question. A recent study that was published in the Journal of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery demonstrated patients who have breast implants for augmentation present a little differently than patients who do not in regards to the diagnosis of breast cancer, that they're more likely to present with a palpable mass. What that means is the efficacy of mammogram and screening in regards to patients with implants is less efficacious. So we're missing a percent of that breast tissue.
Does that depend on how large the implantation is or the results of the test or both?
I've not seen a correlation with the volume of augmentation or the size of the device, but you could imagine there are specific displacement techniques that are used for patients with devices to overcome missing tissue, but about 10% of the breast tissue may be missed with patients who have augmentation with implant devices. So that is a real problem.
Well, thank you very much for letting me know. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Val. Yeah. Okay, and now on to Sarah in Albany. As I've been saying, Sarah, we're almost out of time. Give us what you got.
Hi. I've been on PremPro 1.5 milligrams for 10 years for a very rare form of menopause. I was hospitalized for 2 years in Yale with it. They were studying me. And I'm wondering, since my mother had breast cancer, how not good this is. I can't even be touched for a mammogram. My breasts are so painful. Is it because of all the hormones?
Sarah, very good question. It sounds like your case is complicated. What I can tell you is if you can't, accomplish the mammogram, at a minimum, try for ultrasound evaluation. And really the key question here is, how old was your mother at diagnosis? And then I think you could work from there in terms of looking at your genetic risk and requirements for screening.
Thank you. I can't have an ultrasound either because it's so painful, but I did have a CAT scan.
Okay, that's also effective, yes.
Thank you, Sarah. Okay, and now on to Joanne in Woodstock. Joanne, bring it. We got to hurry up here. Go ahead. Joanne.
I get a thermogram annually. I'm 68. I have never had any problem. I feel a thermogram has no radiation and shows any abnormality before a mammogram, and there's no false positives. What do you say about thermography versus mammography and radiation, which is cumulative?
Okay, you got 1 minute to say all of that. Go ahead, Doc.
Joanne, this is the best question. You saved it for the last. So the answer is, the radiologists who specialize in breast imaging that I work with are very concerned about the reliability of thermogram, and that it's not an effective, proven methodology or innovation for screening. And we have seen malignancy that thermogram has missed, and patients will present with late-stage disease. So it's a very concerning modality. I don't think we have enough information to utilize it effectively as a mass screening tool as of yet. And the radiation from the mammogram is minimal. You're more likely to get more radiation taking a flight to Miami.
Joanne, I wish
I'm still alive.
I'm happy.
Yeah, me too. Congratulations, Joanne. All right, we are just about out of time. I want to thank everyone who called in. Apologize to no one because no one was left on the line. I'd also like to thank Dr. Gabriel Kaufman of St. Peter's Breast Surgery for joining us today. Underwriting support for the Vox Pop comes from George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts. Family owned and operated for over 75 years, serving Western Massachusetts with propane and full service heating and plumbing installation services and deliveries. GeorgePropane.com. Thanks, everyone, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowick. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok, and stay tuned now for the Media Project.